We took a field trip yesterday to Fredericksburg, Texas, to go into the Hill Country to see the National Museum of the Pacific War and to eat at one of our favorite restaurants, the Hilltop Cafe. I was talking to our buddy Don last night, and he said, "My, how you guys have grown up. In the old days, when you went to training camp, in the evening you'd go out to strip bars and bars, and you'd hang out till 2 in the morning. Now you go to Fredericksburg, have some peaches, and go to the World War II Museum."
Yeah, I guess we're getting old.
It was a great trip, and the National Museum of the Pacific War is a fascinating place in Fredericksburg. If you're ever there, you need to go by. This museum takes all day, maybe even 2 days, because there are many different parts of the museum. There's the Admiral Nimitz Museum, which we didn't even see. There's the Pacific Combat Zone, which we didn't even see. There's the Memorial Courtyard, which we didn't see. We went in and bought our tickets, and we said, "We have 2 hours. What should we see?" And they said, without a doubt, the George Herbert Walker Bush Gallery. That is a fantastic place. And we had 2 hours, and we needed about 6 hours to see it all.
Yeah, we didn't scratch the surface of that thing.
It takes you through the late 20s into the 30s. You basically start with the stock market crash, and it takes you throughout the Great Depression and all of the events that led up to World War II. And this focuses on the Pacific Theater, but it also brings you up to speed on everything that happened around the globe in Europe and the Pacific. And it takes you bit by bit, battle by battle, artifact by artifact, through the entire World War II Pacific experience. And at the end of our 2 hours, I came to the conclusion that our current generation is a generation of wusses compared to those people in the 40s. Back then, American men were running off to the U.S. Army office to enlist, to go to war, to defend the country. Today, American men get ticked off if a website doesn't download in 3 seconds or less.
True.
That's how soft we are today and what wusses we are today. And we just get wussier and wussier with each generation.
Right.
It was just a tough day. You know?
What those guys had to go through was amazing.
I mean, the world was just upside down. There was turmoil everywhere. I mean, how we had the idea that we could stay neutral through all that, with everything that was going on in Europe, everything that was going on in China and Japan and in the South Pacific leading up to what happened on December 7th. I would like to think, though, just like there were thousands who signed up after September 11th, if it did turn that crazy and we were on the verge of World War III, and of course warfare is so much different now than it was then, but I'd like to think that we would be resilient and, you know, everyone would buckle down and fight the good fight together until victory was won.
Yeah.
If times were really desperate.
Your statement is accurate. You would like to think that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, 9/11, more people died in 9/11 than died in Pearl Harbor. And as you said, thousands signed up.
Not a whole nation.
Yes.
Well, yeah, but
thousands.
It's not
a generation signed up.
It's also a different type of war. I mean, we declared war after that, though. That was an act by a nation, though. That was not just a select few group of, you know, terrorists.
So there's
a difference in the attack.
Let's say that it was actually Afghanistan that had done 9/11, and it was a nation. You're saying that it would have gone from thousands to millions signing up, as long as it was under the auspices of a nation as opposed to just a paramilitary terrorist group.
Let's say it was China that had done 9/11. A massive force.
Yeah, then I would think that, yeah, millions, I think, would. Because if you're talking globally, just like it was then. I mean, we declared war on Japan and Germany and Italy and the Axis powers. I mean, it was a global war we were getting into.
I don't think so. I think we're so much softer now. I think the idea of the American dream is so much different now. And I do not think we would have had the nation going off to sign up to go to war. There's no way. We're way too soft. Back then, life was so hard. Plus, you were coming off the Depression. You were still in the Depression. So it was a nice alternative. But today, Everybody's in their nice three-bedroom, two-bath house with their two cars and their kick-ass softball games on the weekend. And
I can't sign up for a war. I got to go to the lake this weekend.
Right. It's a much softer lifestyle today than it was back then, battling the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. And just, I mean, life was just harder back then.
Yeah, there's no doubt. It was a different time. And it's pretty incredible because this focuses on what happened in the South Pacific. And doing some research on this before, there were times where it didn't look real good for us there either. You know, right after we joined in 42 and in 43, trying to get through some of those islands. You know, before Midway happened, it was in doubt there. And if Japan defeated us there, and they had been building up, they had been going through decades of military buildup. And my gosh, even at the end of the war, there were still, I think the stat was over 3 million Japanese soldiers throughout the South Pacific and ready to defend the homeland of Japan.
Well, we had also had practiced island hopping. So we would just hop over islands that that's all right. They got that one fortified. We don't need that one so much.
Yeah.
And so that's why you had, even after the war, there were still Japanese ready to fight because they were still on an island.
Waiting for us, yeah.
I think the stat was there were still 5 million troops, Japanese troops, at the time we dropped the two big bombs.
Maybe that was in 3 million were ready to defend the homeland. The others were scattered throughout the South Pacific.
Yeah, and that was one reason why we went ahead and dropped the big bomb, because we felt like that if there had been a negotiated peace, that the Japanese soldiers wouldn't adhere to that. That they were raised, there was one thing that we read, that the Japanese kids back then, and I thought this reeked of Al-Qaeda, the Japanese kids back in the late 1800s and early 1900s were raised every day in school. They pledged to die for the emperor.
Yeah, they said there was no greater honor than to die for the emperor, and kids have to repeat that day in, day out. That gets beaten into your head. That becomes a part of your culture.
Mm-hmm. Boy, and how about some of the island warfare, guys landing on those little boats, going through with artillery fire, machine gun fire, and those Japanese were so dug in. You know, it was literally yard by yard trying to take those little bitty islands.
You know, war gives me such tired head and crazy head and hopeless head. When you start studying it, you start wading into it, and you realize just this whole front line of men, these young men with full lives and families, friends, and you are just cannon fodder. You're just the first few hundred we're going to send up on this island, so you all get blown away in hopes that the guys behind you will be able to get up there.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable that a human life reduced to cannon fodder just to kind of provide protection for the guy behind him.
There was one exhibit about the Sullivan brothers, five brothers from Waterloo, Iowa, that were all aboard the same boat, and that boat was blown up. And President Roosevelt personally wrote a letter to their mother when he heard about that and expressed his sympathy and condolences.
Yeah, I cried during that exhibit.
Wasn't that awful?
Yes.
All five of them, and it showed a picture of them, and you could just see by looking at them, you could tell, you know, which one was the cut-up and which one was the shy one, and you kind of... You felt like you knew him just by looking at this picture, and all five of them die on that ship. And that letter that President Roosevelt had to write to that mother, wow, how do you write that? Mm. And then after that, the Navy decided we can't put brothers on the same ship anymore. Got to split them up.
Yeah.
Yet the ticket still sends its morning show all on the same plane.
Okay, that's
a little different.
Kind of unrelated. Yeah. It was great. It's great artifacts there, too. You know, real-life Japanese artillery. Our anti-aircraft guns. They had a dive bomber that had crashed on an island that they
cool
had secured.
The full-scale, full-size planes out there. The exhibits were really good, and as we're walking through this really top-notch place, I'm thinking, this is weird it's in Fredericksburg to me.
Yeah. It's because...
It's a little small town.
It branched off of the original Admiral Nimitz Museum. Nimitz, who was the co-leader of the Pacific Assault, I guess, with MacArthur. He was born in Fredericksburg, so I guess they got the rights to the Nimitz Museum, and then having George Bush, the first one, be from Texas. Somehow they got the rights to the National Museum of the Pacific War. I was mesmerized by the individual exhibits of the uniforms of all the soldiers from both sides and what they carried with them. You know, they would have the uniform and the helmet and the gun, and then they'd have their little toiletry kits and their some of the soldiers' diaries and letters that they wrote, and all that stuff is fascinating, just to read those letters that they were writing in the trenches.
Yeah, and I've always been fascinated by the war in the Pacific. That's where my dad served. He was a Marine pilot, and he got over there as the Japanese were on the retreat. We had won at Midway, but a lot of those islands, the Solomon Islands, Guam, even Midway, he was on that island at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made me regret even more something we've talked about before that I didn't document with him late in his life before he passed away. Just what, okay, take me through a day. You went from Hawaii to the Solomon Islands on a battleship. What was that like?
Mm-hmm. You said he got to a point where he really didn't want to talk about the war.
He didn't know. He really didn't. You know, I lost an uncle in military service 10 years after World War II, and it just wasn't talked about. And if it was brought up, and he liked to talk about the planes, and he flew, which was missing from the exhibit yesterday. I thought for sure we'd see a Corsair there somewhere. The plane of the South Pacific. The Wildcat was instrumental in the P-51 Mustang and all that, but the F-4U Corsair was one bad dude, and that's what my dad flew, and that wasn't there. And he liked to talk about that, and we'd build models, you know, of those planes when I was a kid. And
did he blow away Japanese?
You know, I don't think he ever did. He went on reconnaissance missions and things like that, and they were in full retreat by the time he got there. And
you shoot him in the butt?
I don't think so. I don't think they went on several missions, you know, trying to take out submarines, but I don't think they ever took out any. Or if they did, he didn't talk about it. And boy, I thought that museum did a great job in describing some of the things my dad did tell me about, the atrocities of the Japanese to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they took over Indonesia and parts of Manchuria and China. Their treatment of the Chinese was just awful. And my dad served there in China as we were regaining China and trying to get them back on their feet. And, you know, he heard the stories from them, and they were so appreciative of the American pilots and American soldiers that came to liberate them. And it just brought all those things home. And seeing that there was a leather jacket there that looked just like the one my dad used to have. And for some reason, when we moved from Chicago, he gave it to my next-door neighbor to go duck hunting in.
Can't believe that.
And at the time, I thought, well, that was real nice of my dad. And now I think, man, I wish we still had that leather jacket. And it also made me think of the artifacts that we do have. You know, they're just, I have them in a couple of shadow boxes and things like that. You know, that maybe we should lend them out to some sort of museum.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's not many World War II vets around who have things like that. And those items become more and more precious, and I would eventually want them back. But, you know, like, I didn't see the type of helmet that my dad had exactly. I think that'd be kind of cool for other people to see that.
I was thinking about that yesterday. How many more World War II veterans do we have? In 10 more years, will they all be gone?
Yeah.
Because they're all 90 now, right?
90s, yeah.
Boy, I tell you, the fascinating story, I didn't know much about Doolittle's raid, which was one of the first raids that we did on mainland Japan. It was not a military thing. It was just a psychological thing, just to hit them there because the Japanese thought that they were invulnerable at the beginning of this whole deal. And we sent those guys in there.
They pretty much knew they were on a death mission.
Yeah, and they just had to crash land. Hopefully, they were just trying to make it over into an area of, China.
China, where we had
a bit of a stronghold.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to. I thought that was interesting. And then also reading about the hit on Nagasaki. And those planes were well beyond their range when they did. And how it ran out of gas as it hit the runway, coming back from delivering the Fat Man bomb.
Wow. It was also interesting to see the role of the state of Texas in World War II. There were internment camps here. There were POW camps here.
Yeah.
Boy, that whole internment thing, as soon as the war starts, if you're of Japanese descent in this country, even if you're a third-generation American, you were sent to this camp.
You're in prison.
That's pretty harsh. Yeah. That's the way it was. That was Roosevelt's first order, basically. after the declaration of war was anyone that's of Japanese ancestry, get in this camp. And the prisoner of war camps I was fascinated by because they took those prisoners and they put them to work. They farmed our land. They built our roads. Why can't we do that with our prisoners today?
Because we can't violate their rights like that. They have the right not to work.
That drives me crazy.
Fear of escape, maybe?
Why can't we make our prisoners build our roadways and farm our land? Why
can't
we do
labor.
That? Yeah.
I don't know.
It just makes me nuts that we don't do that.
Also, think about how in World War II, how you got Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams, all these guys going to war. It just seems odd to me now. We only had Pat Tillman go after 9/11, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everyone signed up.
How many athletes would run out to sign up?
That's what we were talking about at the start of the segment. That's how different it is today.
I guess a lot of them were called into it mandatorily. Mandatorily?
Drafted?
Sure.
Drafted, yeah.
But, yeah, I would say no athletes. Maybe one out of a million. A Pat Tillman. No athlete is going to leave his million-dollar job and go off to the war. And we would be fought so much differently today. That's the other thing that struck me. And this is generational, too. Every generation can say this. But back then, a couple generations ago, war was fought so primitively compared to how it would be fought today.
Yeah.
And they're showing they had a great little video set up in each section. You go to Iwo Jima or Solomon Islands or whatever section you were touring. They had this little video board that you would start, and it would show on a map how this fleet came in here and chased this fleet out and where this fleet hit and how they doubled back around.
Yeah.
And the way a war could never be fought today, because you'd know exactly every movement of every ship today. But back then, you had to see them to know. Right. You had to send out patrol boats to know where that fleet was headed.
That was the key to Midway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they
broke the code.
Yeah, diagrammed that and how they knew where the Japanese fleet was headed and they jumped them. Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was like a walking documentary. I'd say you need at least 3 hours for it.
Yeah.
Four would probably be better, and you may just be exhausted with tired head at that point. But, yeah, you need at least that much time to get through it.
The Hill Country was really burned up. It was depressing to see, like the entire state of Texas, as we drove around. It's just nothing but solid brown. Everything is dead. There's no grass. Mm-mm. The trees are dead. It's just, it's really... Really
I've never
depressing.
Seen that dry down
you,
here.
You want to hear a depressing scene? As we were driving down a little two-lane highway, and I looked over in a pasture, and there, laying on its side, was a dead cow, and it had already started liquefying, and you could see its body melting into the hay, and a couple predators torn into its belly. And
man.
Through all of that, we did end up at the Hilltop Cafe last night in Doss, just outside of Fredericksburg, and had another tremendous meal.
Yeah, how does that place in the middle of nowhere have such great food? And it's not,
I don't know.
And it's not the stupid country great food of got the best chicken fried steak and you know, I mean, like they have like gourmet high end restaurant food in that thing too.
So that was great. And then after dinner, we drove to the Fredericksburg Middle School, where George took a trip down memory lane. He'll tell us that story. And the legend of Pie Eater coming up next on The Ticket.
Sports Radio 1310 The Ticket.